Good afternoon.
Let's talk after.
Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is now 12:35 p.m. It is Wednesday. It is March 16th, and we are in the State Capitol, Room 120, the Grunberg Room. Here are the members present. We have Representative Miller. We have Representative Chris Tompkins. We've got Representative Foster, Representative Clayman, Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Chair Ledoux, and I see that Representative Lynn has just joined us. So, we have a quorum to begin. Everybody please silence their cell phones or they're going to end up bringing donuts. Thank you to Christy Blair, our House Recording Secretary, and to Christy Perrin from the Juno LIO for tech teleconference support. So it looks like I'm saying thanks to both Christies today. Today we are back on House Bill 205, Representative Millett's Omnibus Crime Bill. We're going to be focusing on pretrial policies today, citation versus arrest, risk-based release, and pretrial supervision of higher-risk defendants. On our desks, we have a copy of today's presentation and a memo responding to some of the questions from Monday. To begin, I'm going to invite Grace up to go over the presentation. Grace, you want to introduce yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Fantastic. For the record, my name is Grace Abbott, and I'm staff to Representative Millett. And hopefully we'll have the presentation up on the top here as well. Awesome. Okay.
And maybe we should turn the lights down.
Okay. So as this warms up, just to preface the presentation, as Chair Ledoux mentioned, hopefully we'll be able to focus on pretrial, which is the first segment of the recommendations. I don't want to be too repetitive. Obviously, we heard a fantastic presentation from the Criminal Justice Commission on their recommendations at the previous hearing. My hope today is just to hone in on pretrial, and obviously we're joined by some of the state's experts in all of these policies, and as much as possible, I want the experts to be in front of you answering your questions. So I'm not trying to be evasive. If I punt questions to folks in the room, I think that they'll be able to provide some of the best support possible. So beginning here on recommendation one, the commission discussed the options of citation versus arrest. And as we learned, there obviously a substantial amount of those incarcerated awaiting it, being in the pretrial phase, awaiting their sentencing. And so one of the measures to reduce that population, to reduce the amount that we're paying for folks to be incarcerated and to make sure that those who are incarcerated are those who pose the largest public safety risk, the commission hoped to encourage citations in as many cases as possible, obviously with the priority of protecting public safety. The sections that are addressed or that address this particular recommendation are sections 42 through 45 of the bill, and that's version H that we're looking on of the CS. These sections cover the presumption to cite, which obviously happens on the law enforcement end, the goal being that in cases where there's little to no public safety risk, that an officer would cite as opposed to arrest an offender. It also covers the civil protection for officers and notice to appear requirements. The commission recommended expanding the use of citations, like I said, in place of arrest for lower-level nonviolent offenses. So we're talking C felonies that are nonviolent, non-domestic violence or sexual assault or sexual offense related and misdemeanor offenses, while allowing for a broad discretion for an officer, for those who are experts, for those in the field, to arrest when a person presents a danger to themselves, certainly, or, you know, in particular others. Also, if they present a flight risk or a harm to property. One of the specific carve-outs is for cases of arson, where there are cases in which it doesn't present a harm directly to someone's safety, but a harm to property, and obviously is a serious offense. 76% of pretrial admissions to prison are for misdemeanor charges, and 56% of those pretrial admissions to prison are for nonviolent misdemeanor charges. But obviously, public safety is still our priority in this case. Recommendation 2 touched on risk-based release decision-making. The sections addressed are numerous, but some of the important parts of this recommendation as they appear in the bill are to consider when approaching a bail hearing, when approaching a release decision, to consider pay, to consider their ability to pay. And we know that a significant amount of those incarcerated pretrial are due to their inability to pay. Some people who can't afford $500 of bail, and some people who genuinely can't afford any amount of bail. Their financial situation is such that they simply can't afford it. It also limits the judicial discretion to detain low and moderate risk pretrial defendants with nonviolent, non-DUI misdemeanors or Class C felonies. This also references to the newly created, within this bill, pretrial services officers and what they can arrest for, which is violating a court order, so violating conditions of their release pretrial. It also allows that pretrial services officers can search for alcohol if that was a condition of release. They could also search for drugs or perform drug tests if that was a condition of release. It also touches on third-party custodians who may or may not be third-party custodians. Obviously, we want, if in the case that third-party custodians are used, that they be the most responsible and the most likely to ensure pretrial success. It also touches on PFD garnishment, the ability for PFDs to be garnished in the case that there is a pretrial failure. Referring back to some of the data here, there's been an 81% growth in the pretrial inmate population. 56% of those pretrial admissions, like I said, are for nonviolent misdemeanor charges. This pie chart gives a good sense of what our prison population actually looks like by status. You can see that 50% are sentenced. This was a number that frankly surprised me, that 50% of those in our prisons have been sentenced, and that the 28 of those are pretrial. It's a significant amount of people who have not been sentenced that are taking up our prison beds, which we know do cost us about $142 a day. This chart allows us to understand since 2005 how long defendants are staying incarcerated for pretrial. As we had mentioned, as the commission had mentioned in our previous hearing, 2005 is about the time that we made significant adjustments to our criminal justice system, to sentencing specifically. And while it may not look like the days in which people are spending detained are significant, always remembering that these people are costing us $142 a day, and we're talking thousands of people. These numbers really, really do add up, both for our own fiscal situation, but also for the success rate of people's corrections experience. We also were presented with data about the success of monetary bail, and we are led to understand that monetary bail does lead to a significant amount of detention, even on low bond amounts. As you can see here in some of the bulleted points, for bills of $2,500 or more, they're 66% unable to post bond. For the category just under that, for $2,499, up to $1,000, 62% are unable to post bail. And below that, we can see that 57 and 36% beneath that $1,000 range are unable to post bail. So when we're talking about people who are just able to come up with that secured monetary bail or unsecured monetary bail, they really are experiencing a lot of financial difficulties and just genuinely can't make that bail, which results in people staying longer in our prisons. And something else that the commission had spoken to us about is that a risk assessment tool is what's potentially lacking in some of these release decisions, that what we can do to provide better pretrial success and lower amount of people incarcerated is by allowing judges this tool to assess someone's risk. The actuarial tool that we discussed briefly on Monday, which allows people to determine whether or not they will be successful if they're released from prison before their sentencing date. It's not used right now other than just sort of a judge's own discretion, but this risk assessment tool would be based on the work of pretrial services officers. It would be, and their actuarial tool, so they would be coming up with this risk assessment for judges. Because secured bond at this point is ordered in the majority of cases, release is often linked to ability to pay rather than their actual risk of pretrial failure, which could be committing another crime, violating their conditions of release, and not appearing in their court hearing. So recommendations 3 and 4 are linked in this bill, and that's pretrial supervision of higher-risk defendants released pending trial. And this is, in my mind, one of the most important parts of this bill. This creates the Pretrial Services Division and Pretrial Services Officers under the Department of Corrections. And we have fantastic people from the Department of Corrections today with us who can speak to their concepts for implementation. It's a new concept here in the state to have people providing this level of supervision, this level of risk assessment before people are sentenced. Some amount of supervision, as we know, is available during parole or probation, but this is a new concept and one that's a pretty exciting opportunity. The other section that's touched in this recommendation is Section 152, which touches the court system and their ability to provide hearing reminders for defendants. And these reminders could be as simple as what we receive from the dentist's office reminding us to go to an appointment. And the data has shown that far and away they are an incredibly effective tool, a simple tool, but an effective tool in having people show up for their hearings. Pretrial supervision can include sort of a spectrum, minimal supervision being that of just the court date reminders that I just mentioned, basic supervision, which would include in-office appointments, phone calls, field visits, and then enhanced supervision, which would be recommended for higher risk, or I guess perhaps to rephrase that, those who are most likely to fail pretrial, and that's higher frequency contacts, drug and alcohol testing, and electronic monitoring. So that runs the gamut of my slides. I wanted to keep it short so we could hear from the experts today. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have right off the bat or at the chair's discretion, obviously, to move right to our expert testimony.
Do we have any questions for Grace? All right. Well, thanks very much, Grace.
Thank you.
So the next person up is I want to invite Nancy Mead from the court system to speak about pretrial.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'd like to clarify that I am not one of the commissioners, as some of the other experts in this room. I did attend nearly all of the Criminal Justice Commission meetings as a spectator, but I would like to comment on the bill itself that came after the commission's recommendations and how it might affect the court system. And also to clarify and put on the record, the court system is neutral on this bill. We were very supportive of the process, and as required by SB 64 passed in 2014, that Chief Justice did appoint three of the commissioners. So the process was something that we were interested in doing. The actual provisions itself were neutral on. I just wanted to talk about the way things would work under the pretrial provisions and how they work now and the changes that would be occurring under the bill. Right now, the judges make release decisions, bail decisions, based on public safety and the threat to the victim and to the community, and the defendant balanced against the defendant's constitutional right to bail. And the prosecutor and the public defender each make a recommendation, and a bail amount and conditions are determined and ordered by the judge. Under the changes, and specifically in Section 51 is the main change for the court system, the judges would have differing levels of discretion with respect to releasing defendants depending on the defendant's risk assessment as provided to the judge by that new pretrial services office within the Department of Corrections. And the statute, Section 51, sets out very carefully what the judge can do, must do, and where the discretion lies. So when somebody is arrested under the new provisions in Title 33, the DOC Pretrial Services Office, within 24 hours, will do an assessment of that individual. As you heard, the assessment is, in my communications with the Department of Corrections, I understand to be done without a personal interview, but based on records and information that the Pretrial Services Office will have available to it about that person's criminal history, their background, perhaps if there's evidence of drugs or alcohol. There are different questions that you can ask and information that you can look up. The Pretrial Services Office will then prepare a report that it will transmit to the court, and the court will then know the risk assessment score, say 3 on a 1 to 5 scale. That score will be put on the tool that we've heard about on a grid, more or less, and then compare. You go down a certain number and across for the current charge, and you figure out where the judge's discretion lies. That whole chart idea is reflected to some extent, I guess you could say, in Section 51. There are some things in Section 51, subsection A, that the judge will not have discretion. They must release a person on their own recognizance. And then that statute goes on to say what conditions the judge has the discretion to put on the person who is released. And there are certain things that the judge then, for certain crimes and with certain risk assessment scores, the judge can consider releasing if there's clear and convincing evidence that there's increased risk to the public. The judge can release with certain findings with more conditions on them, and certain things that the judge has absolute discretion to do, perhaps the more serious felonies. So the court system is able to do this. I think there are some drafting issues with respect to Section 51 that the sponsor's office is aware of and might be trying to clarify a little bit so that all the parties and the courts are able to know exactly what that statute is going to require, but we can do that. There's also changes in the bill about what bail hearings a defendant is entitled to have. Currently, a defendant whose bail is set and who can't make it is entitled to ask for a bail review hearing if they have a change in circumstances, if they have new information, and that new information can't be, well, I just can't pay. This bill would allow the inability to pay to get the defendant one bail hearing to have that reviewed by another judicial officer or the same judicial officer. So that's a change. Other than that, all the pretrial provisions are something that the court can handle. I'd be happy to answer questions about how it will work. I think some of the details about how the Pretrial Services Office within DOC will exactly do those assessments are still to be worked out. I know DOC is here to talk about their thinking. These provisions won't be effective for another year to allow that pretrial services office to get off the ground and provide those reports to the court system for the bail reviews. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Representative Clayman.
Just one question. I know whenever somebody comes up in front of for bail today, there's a fairly extensive form that the court fills out and checks some boxes and fills in different findings before they release on bail. I would assume with this, if we pass this statute, that the court system will probably in due course come up with a new bail form that makes sure the judges are following some of the different requirements here.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, when this bill passes, one of the big things that the court administrative staff does, me included, is to determine all the things that have to change in response to any piece of legislation. And we'll certainly have a meeting with our forms attorney to see what needs to change there, as well as all the other members of the staff who have whose jobs might touch on some of these things. But yes, we will be updating lots of forms and training materials for judges and providing judges with bench book materials is what we call them, so that they can have at their fingertips exactly what the new laws say.
Thank you.
Further questions? I've actually got a question. So are we actually going to have bail for people who can pay?
To the chair, yes, some people who have a certain risk assessment score and charged with a certain crime, according to the grid and to the statute, will be released on their own recognizance, meaning no monetary bail. They can still have plenty of other conditions. Subsection B has 17 or 18 conditions that can be imposed on a person, even if released on their personal or own recognizance. And also there can be unsecured performance and appearance bonds, meaning that they don't have to put the full amount of a bond up front, but if they then don't appear or perform, they owe that money to the state.
Well, I guess I'm just curious as to, so let's say you've got a defendant who can pay the bail, but they're a low-risk assessment. Why would you charge that defendant the bail? I mean, if they're a low-risk assessment, then they're a low-risk assessment. Why should, simply because somebody can pay, would you make them pay if the payment isn't necessary to assure anything? I mean, what's the whole purpose of the bail?
To the chair, the ability to pay is not weighed initially in the bail decisions. If somebody on the risk assessment score is low risk, and perhaps an A misdemeanor, under A they would be released OR. There isn't a further delving into the person's ability to pay. So the ability to pay, I think, can be best explained as the an underpinning for the recommendation that perhaps bail decisions should be set in some other way, because the effects today are those without the ability to pay are being retained in jail, even if their bail is low. So the judge isn't really considering ability to pay. They're following this, what will become the statute should this become law, and releasing more people, and hopefully that will help those with an inability to pay. But it's not as if they're saying you have money and therefore you will have a high bail amount. Is that responsive to your question?
Well, actually, I'm still not quite following it, because if for people who don't have the ability to pay, and you're saying, okay, they don't have the ability to pay, and so we're not going to require them to pay because we think they're going to show up without paying, agree with that. But I'd say if somebody has the ability to pay, but you think they're going to show up, why should you make them pay?
And to the chair, I don't think the courts will make them pay. I don't think the courts will know a person's ability to pay. That is not one of the initially, the judge will just look at subsection A. If you're within this risk assessment score and this is your current charge, you will be released to OR. It doesn't matter if you're Bill Gates or somebody with no money at all. So that is just what A says. B, here are the conditions that can be imposed on that person in order to protect the public and the victim, and that will be regardless of ability to pay. So it is regardless of ability to pay. The risk assessment score, as recommended by the pretrial services office, coupled with the current charges, will determine what release conditions they have.
And that makes sense. So in other words, Bayong is going to be a thing of the past?
Not necessarily, to the chair. Not necessarily. There are certain crimes that this really leaves the judge with the same discretion that they have now. For example, an unclassified felony or Class A felony. So if you have murder, and the judge today would be inclined to set a $20,000 or $50,000 bail amount, that person there are not specific recommendations to the judge that the person must have certain conditions or ought to have certain conditions or certain conditions won't be recommended. Those are on the grid that the commission was always looking at. Unshaded areas is what we've been thinking of. Those are areas where the court retains its discretion to set conditions and bail amounts as it deems appropriate for that individual.
But why would you ever set money as a condition when you know that there are some people who can pay the money and other people who can't pay the money? Why is money a consideration? Period.
To the chair, I think traditionally in all bail decisions, money is something that gets people to come back to the court. If they think they're going to lose the money, it's a way to ensure appearance at your next court date and to ensure that you perform the conditions that you must perform under bail. It is a tool that causes people to comply, and that's why it has been used and why it still can be used in certain conditions where the judge deems it appropriate.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Just a follow-up on that. Just by way of example, if you had somebody that was arrested or arrested for criminal mischief and a relatively low-level misdemeanor and had no prior convictions, had no prior record, that person under this statute would be released OR on their own cognizance, regardless of whether they were a multimillionaire or a pauper.
Through the chair, that is right. If they fall within that subsection A, low risk, low-level nonviolent crime, that would be an OR release. The judge could have conditions, but not monetary bail on that person.
And in a follow-up, a similar person that may have. Similar crime, but a little bit more of a record, and under the bail, under the grid, comes up, and they say, well, they should have a $250 bail, and they're not a millionaire, they're the pauper that I've discussed. That person would, after having a period of time trying to post the $250, now could come back into court and say, well, I know my prior record isn't great, and I thought I might be able to post $250. I can't. Then the court could decide whether to let them out without posting the $250, recognizing their financial circumstances.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that's right. They can get one additional hearing for inability to pay. And I'd just also point out that this bill would give the judge additional tools, the unsecured performance and appearance bond, so that they don't have to, depending on the scenario exactly, but come up with $250, but maybe just 10% of that. And then only if they no-show or violate their terms would they owe the remainder of the $250. So the judges are always happy to have additional tools to ensure compliance, and this provides that.
And then the last follow-up.
Through the chair.
Right. I think the third scenario would be the person charged with murder, whether they were a pauper or a millionaire, the likelihood is they would have a bail of $50,000 or more, and their ability or inability to pay would play little or no part in the fact that because it's a crime against the person and a violent crime, that there would be bail, and under any expectation under the commission and whatnot, that person would have bail set before they would ever get out of jail.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I think that's generally correct. Yes, generally.
Any other questions for Ms. Mead? All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Next person we have up here to speak is Quinlan Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm a public defender for the state of Alaska. I was also a member of the commission and participated in every meeting and or just about and the subgroups that broke down and discussed each one of these policies. I am happy to answer any questions about the discussion of the commission and the reasoning behind the policies. I'm also happy to answer questions about these policies from a defense perspective and impact on the agency. I can also have Tracy Wallenberg, who's the deputy director for the appellate division, ask more technical questions about the actual language in the bill. We sort of split up the duties. First of all, I'd like to describe some of the deliberations that went into this. As you may have heard, we spent a lot of time looking over data, and the goal was to save money. That was, you know, one of our primary goals. But what we paid attention to the entire time was to make sure that the policies that we were supporting also maintained and enhanced public safety. Reducing recidivism was part of this plan. It was part of the deliberations the entire time. And so during those deliberations, we looked at and took in the perspectives and concerns of law enforcement, members of the victims advocates community, the prosecutor's office, to ensure that what we were doing based upon this data actually had its intended effect, was to not only save money, but actually create a foundation for reducing recidivism, and in some cases, actually reducing recidivism by themselves. Reinvestment, and this is obviously an important part, but many of these initiatives are positive in their own right and will help reduce recidivism. In particular, pretrial bail release that you're discussing. It became clear through the data that we saw that pretrial detention was in itself caused increasing recidivism and is in fact a criminogenic factor that causes further crime in the future. And so that was one of our significant considerations that drove this. Also, the idea that bail itself, monetary bail, doesn't have a meaningful effect on what it's intended to do, which is bring somebody back to court and cause them not commit any crimes in the future. Bail, monetary bail, was no better than an unsecured bond in terms of those two factors. And so that drove, to a huge degree, the grid that you were talking about. So someone's ability to pay, as you were discussing, is not really a factor when you're in the section of the grid that will release you without a bail bond. It does become a factor when you're at a higher level of offense, high risk, high level, then ability to pay does become a factor in setting that bond so that it has, in those higher level cases, at least the prospect of doing what it's supposed to do, ensuring return and preventing future crime. But there was all the data indicated that for the low level and mid-range offenses, it had no effect and was actually counterproductive. So that was a primary concern. There is one thing, at least in this bill, that is not part of the commission's recommendations that I needed to bring to the committee's attention and, in fact, runs counter to the policies and the data that we looked at, and it's the limitation on electronic monitoring credit. And I believe it's Section 61. There's a provision in there that limits it to 120 days. That was not based, I think it's Section 61. Somebody will correct me behind me if I'm wrong. That wasn't part of the commission's recommendations. That came in elsewhere. What we found and what we were looking at was that long jail sentences are not more effective at changing behavior than short jail sentences. And in fact, in some cases, even short jail sentences were counterproductive. The sections for EM credit was not part of the recommendation. And that will limit the option for non-jail detention for individuals. Just capped at 120 days, where currently now that would be available for a longer period of time.
Representative Mellett.
Thank you. So, Quinlan, not to get you in trouble, but can you tell us where the origin of the 120-day restriction came from? And then can you just go elaborate on why 120 days is restrictive and not?
The concern, as it was expressed to me, was that if it were not limited, that would create no incentive to resolve the case, and that someone in the defendant's position would have no incentive, and that after 120 days, because they were no longer getting credit, it would push the case forward. From the defense.
Excuse me, Quinlan. I think that Representative Keller has a question, and I still haven't found the place that we're at.
That's what I was just asking.
Page 36, line 2.
And was that your question, Representative Keller? 36, line 2. Okay. Thank you.
120 days. I don't know where the actual 120 days decision came from to limit it at that amount. But as it was expressed to me that there would be no incentive without a cap to sort of resolve the case, that delay would occur. But I would note for the committee that it's the judge that sets the trial date. Continuances may be at the defendant's request, but the defendant has to have a reason for their request to delay the case, and that's ruled on by the judge. There are benefits to having somebody on EM credit that are beyond just saving money. I mean, once you're in jail, that separates somebody from their job, their support network, and any work they may be doing on rehabilitation. And so that would interfere and interrupt with that.
He's first.
Representative Chris Tompkins.
I was going to attempt to defer to my elder, but thank you, Madam Chair.
That would be just about anybody around here.
That would be.
I think it'd be me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quinlan, through the chair, I guess as a follow-up to Representative Millett's question, while it sounds like you don't know the origin of that particular section, was there any pushback from the commission's work relating to electronic monitoring credit?
That came after the commission's report came out. I wasn't part of the discussions where that was added to the bill, so I couldn't speak to the discussions that went on. The commission hasn't met and discussed the bill in a session since. I'm just commenting both as public defender, as a commissioner. We did not recommend this.
Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Quinn, my understanding is that actually under existing law today, a person that's on pretrial electronic monitoring could get credit for more than 120 days for the time on electronic monitoring.
That's correct.
And then follow up. It seems to me one of the reasons why this may not have been part of the commission's recommendation is that under Criminal Rule 45 and the constitutional right to speedy trial, that that's interpreted as 120 days as the timeline within which a case has to come to trial, and so that there's already substantial structures within the system that kind of forces cases to get to trial within 120 days, and that, in fact, the defendant actually has to waive their speedy trial rights to not have the case come to trial in 120 days. And in your experience as public defender, how often does it actually come up what are the cases that actually have anybody waiving their speedy trial rights with any frequency past 120 days? So what is a practical matter? Does this really ever come to play?
Through the chair, most trials and most cases go beyond 120 days except for misdemeanors. I don't think there are very many felonies that come to trial in 120 days. Waiving time under Rule 45 is common. It starts from the beginning and often results in waiver pre-indictment, which is during negotiation process. It gets waived throughout for filing motions. It gets told during that period, and it will often get waived to investigate or prepare a defense. I think there are some misdemeanors that do get to trial in that period of time. I don't know the exact figure for that. I wouldn't say a lot that go to trial. That would be my sort of guesstimate. They get resolved earlier because they resolve by plea, but it takes it more time to go to trial. I suspect that's why the 120-day number was picked, but I wasn't part of that discussion, so I can't say for sure. But my concern is that'll have an impact and undermine some of the broader sort of underlying premise of the commission's report and recommendations. That simply just runs counter to it.
Through the chair.
Yeah, follow up through the chair. Have you seen cases in which defense attorneys, or you have the sense that the defense attorney is actually trying to use the electronic monitoring as a mechanism to keep putting the case off longer and longer and longer and never go to trial? Or, I mean, I can understand that people are waiving Rule 45 to prepare for trial, not really to avoid a plea. If they can cut a deal, they usually want to cut a deal sooner than later. But what's the incidence in the real world of somebody saying, well, you know, I'm going to push this back as long as I can because I'm just carrying on my merry way on the electronic monitors? Is this a real problem, I guess, is the question.
Through the chair. Done properly, the defense lawyer, when requesting a continuance, would need to explain the reason, and the judge would have to rule on it. It could be, I'm not prepared. It could be a number of reasons. It could be, we want more time because the defendant is working on classes, on a program, has something else going on that merits delay. The judge would be aware that the person was on EM credit, and everyone in the courtroom should be aware that that is resulting in credit for them. It would be unethical for a lawyer to delay simply and hide the reason for it, and not, let me say this, it would be unethical for a defense lawyer to mislead a court about why they're doing a delay. So it should be discussed and on the table.
Follow up, please.
And I couldn't tell you exactly how often things are delayed for that, a reason of working on a program.
Actually, let me ask the question a little differently because I was trying to get a slightly different answer. I was asking a different question. I'm not sure what the answer is, but in the public defender world, your agency, can you tell me how many people statewide are released pretrial on electronic monitoring? I mean, in the public defender world, is that a real issue, or is it almost no one is getting released?
No, people are getting released on electronic monitoring.
How many?
That I couldn't answer.
Through the chairs, is it a big percentage, a small percentage, in rough terms?
I'd have to look into that. I'd hate to venture a guess. But it's not insignificant. I mean, people are getting out on electronic monitoring of the public defender clients.
You can continue.
Sure. That was the one concern about the bill that I wanted to raise before the committee. I thought it worth the committee's deliberation whether or not that policy was something they wanted to move forward on. Broadly speaking, normally I don't take positions on bill, but as a commissioner, I do support the bill, and I support the initiatives and recommendations of the committee. They were well thought out, well discussed, and based on sound data, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions on any one of the policies.
So let me see if I understand this. This is, although the way the bill's going generally is so that more people are out prior to trial, this is a change in present law that would make it so that less people are out prior to trial. Is my understanding correct?
Through the chair, it would provide less credit for the time that you're out on electronic monitoring. So if you were out on electronic monitoring for 150 days, you'd only get credit for 120. But it might not necessarily result in somebody going back to jail. It's just a matter of credit. It would result in somebody going back to jail if they then got a 150-day sentence and were out for 150 days. They'd have to go back and do the extra time.
But this is a change from present law. Present law would give you credit for the entire time that you're out.
Correct, if you were under a court order and followed the conditions that permit it. Yes, it scales back what you can have credit for.
Representative Klayman?
I do have another follow-up. One of the perspectives that I often look at life as a legislator is asking the colloquial question, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And in looking at this particular one, can you identify any instances in which a person is, in which a person has been out on electronic monitor and seems to have, for lack of a better description, abused the system and managed to get 2 years of electronic monitoring by delaying their trial for 2 years and then never serves a day in jail? Are you aware of any instance of that ever occurring?
I've heard of cases being lengthy, but I guess the question is whether or not it's appropriate that it went on that long and whether or not somebody wants to have credit. I mean, the premise of the report and the recommendations was that jail itself was a negative thing in many instances for low to moderate risk individuals, that jail sentence itself had a criminogenic impact and increased recidivism. So if you reduce the availability of EM credit, you're going to some people are going to end up spending time in jail when they otherwise wouldn't. The appropriateness of it is, I suppose, something that needs to be balanced here by the committee and is also something that the judge should weigh in on when somebody asks for a continuance. The reasons should be on the table and discussed, and that sort of determines the other body that weighs in on it. I couldn't answer the question. I do know it occurs that people get a fair amount of credit.
Not a follow-up question. I'll just make the observation. I get the answer that he has no instances of knowledge when it's been when this situation has been abused. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions for Quinlan? And then I'm going to call Grace back up here. Representative Millett and then Representative Keller.
So, Quinlan, thanks for pointing that out. And then can you offer some suggestions on policy that other options we may have for credit given on ankle monitoring for more than 4 months in instances where by no fault of their own or no choice of their own, let's say that the court calendar is full, they couldn't get in, and in lieu of them not going back to prison and becoming lifelong prisoners, I guess is a way of putting it, language that would be something that we could, as a committee, consider as an option to the 120 days for the credit?
Through the chair, I have been kind of mulling that over. I've expected this question. I don't have an adequate response to it now.
Okay.
I could certainly continue to work on it. I think the primary safety valve is judicial discretion in this and going forward when the case is prepared and it's time to go forward. That's sort of the primary safety valve that exists now. It's possible that language could be generated to limit it in certain high-level cases where the implication of jail time increasing recidivism isn't as strong. That would be one approach.
And follow up? And can you talk about, you talked about putting folks that are in pretrial position in prison and when they have satisfied their time served, when they come out, they're more likely to commit a crime again because of that portion of time that they spent prior to trial incarcerated. And I'll probably have to ask Pew this, but in your knowledge, what's the length of time in pretrial that you start making worse criminals, I guess is the best way to put it?
24 hours.
24 hours?
Okay. For low-risk individuals. Even a single day in jail can increase recidivism. You know, one of the things that we've been working on in the state has been the PACE model, which I'm sure that you've heard of. The PACE model is based upon this idea that short and swift sanctions for high-risk individuals is appropriate. What I've come to understand is that even Hawaii has found that 8 hours is enough. Somebody will get arrested in the morning on a probation violation. They'll have their hearing that day, and they'll just spend the day, and they'll be released that evening. That has as much of impact as being booked in and spending 24 hours. I couldn't tell you what the length of jail time for higher risk individuals are, but for low risk individuals, it's even a single day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to have that reiterated one more time. Kind of goes to the crux of trying to keep people out of prison in pretrial, and that's one of the stunning things that I saw in that the criminal justice reform was a portion of people that, you know, once they get in jail, they become hardened or worse criminals than the offense that they initially had made. It's some influence within that time spent in jail makes people criminals, and it's pretty scary.
It's not a good environment.
Through the chair, if I may follow up on one other thing, I mean, that was in conjunction with the low amount of monetary bail that would result in somebody's detention was surprising even to me. People with $1,000 or less bail were 50% of those, more than 50% of those individuals were unable to bail out. That is a very low amount of money, and I don't think anyone would ever expect that that would have a real influence on behavior, and that's what the data bore out. We were holding individuals who were low risk merely because they were poor.
Thank you. Did you have a question, Representative Christ Tompkins? Because I think we're going to have to let Quinlan go in a couple of minutes. I think you have another appointment over in the other body.
I do also a follow-up to Representative Millett's question. I guess having someone who is maybe a high-risk individual held in jail, I guess what I'm trying to say is in your answer, you said that a low-risk individual, one's criminality or potential for criminality is enhanced. They spend as little as 24 or even 8 hours in jail. What does the data show for higher-risk individuals? Does a higher-risk individual have the potential to become even more criminal and go up another rung on the ladder?
I'm going to go off my recollection, and I'm sure the Pew will correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection was for high-risk individuals on high-level offenses that the jail did not enhance recidivism. But if I'm wrong, I'm going to go call them and find out, and I'm going to write you a letter and tell you I was wrong. that was my recollection. But the data was clear that for the low risks, Acton was criminogenic. And after I do leave, Tracy Wallenberg is here, and she can answer any questions from the defense perspective if you have any follow-ups.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to call Grace up here right now because I think she may have some perspective as to the rationale for this section.
Amazing, Grace. Absolutely.
Is this better?
Once again, for the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. And the recommendation that Mr. Steiner was speaking to that's found in Section 61 is, as he stated completely correctly, outside of the commission's recommendations. It was a part that was put into this bill through some discussions about what the legislative intent was behind a bill that was passed last year, I believe. And the number is escaping me right now, but it was a bill that the legislature had worked on that was discussed in this committee regarding good time served on electronic monitoring. The thought behind it, and I am happy to stand corrected if anyone has different information, but the thought being that this conformed better with legislative intent, that an entire sentence was not served on electronic monitoring, but that it was simply good time that could be applied pretrial. So in the case was brought up that someone's sentence ended up being 150 days and that they had served those 120 days, that it was still within the purview of the court to not have to basically have that person now have served their entire sentence. And obviously, this is a policy call, and the data and argument of Mr. Quinlan is certainly compelling, and it's obviously within the committee's purview as to whether or not this is a policy that's kept in the bill.
Thank you.
Question for the chair.
Yes.
Isn't that Representative Wilson's bill that we debated extensively last year in this committee? Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be my recollection.
It is. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Grace.
So just an observation. We're in a great position to think about what was our intent when we approved it last year.
Probably there's no one better to interpret our intent. So the next person that I'd like to call, and he is online, is David Hansen, who is with the Department of Public Safety. David, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Certainly. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for the opportunity to provide testimony today on House Bill 205. My name is David Hansen, and I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers based in Anchorage. I've been with the troopers for 22 years, and in my current assignment, I'm the deputy commander of the Alaska Bureau of Highway Patrol, as well as the Alaska State Troopers Division Legislative Liaison. Over the past several weeks, I have been reviewing both Senate Bill 91 and House Bill 205 and have become familiar with the changes in the subsequent versions. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission for the extensive research and work that's been done to arrive at their conclusions on the criminal justice reform and reinvestment. And I'd also like to thank and recognize the diligent work of the lawmakers and sponsors of this bill, without whom none of this would have been possible. Today I'd like to address specifically sections 42 through 45, and in particular section 42, which essentially deals with the arrest versus cite issue for defendants. This version of AS 1225-180, as reflected in section 42, appears to contain a number of compromises that will still allow law enforcement to take control of a situation as needed, but also allows for citations to be issued when appropriate. I think we can all agree that the main concern is still public safety, which includes the safety of the officer, the defendant, and the community. And oftentimes, when certain types of crimes have been committed, issuing a citation to appear in court is or can be an appropriate solution to the problem. This is similar to how a trooper would issue a ticket or summons to a driver for operating a vehicle with a suspended license instead of physically arresting them, provided another driver is available to take the vehicle, of course. So in essence, Section 42 establishes a presumption to cite and summons to court for nonviolent misdemeanors and Class C felonies, with exceptions including significant danger to self or others and certain specified crimes. For infractions or violations, it provides that a peace officer may bring the person before a judge if the violation is, one, for a violation of conditions of release, or two, for disorderly conduct. In urban areas where the local court system is easily accessible, the burden that is created by citing a defendant into court is minimal or non-existent in most cases. The defendant would simply need to make sure that they find a way to court during the normal course of their day, and at worst might need to secure a ride from a friend or via public transportation. But a more significant issue would arise when troopers and officers in rural communities issue a citation for a defendant to appear, but the nearest court is in another community or a significant distance away. Troopers in Western Alaska frequently experience cases where defendants who are issued a summons or citation to appear in court fail to show up. This is a result of a variety of factors, but regardless of the reason, and however justifiable that reason might be, it requires that a warrant be issued and a second response to the rural community by law enforcement is required to serve the warrant. But according to Criminal Rule 38.1, defendants are allowed to appear telephonically for a variety of hearings. If this mechanism is in place and utilized by the defendant, I believe it would solve a number of the concerns law enforcement has regarding multiple trips to take care of a single issue. These concerns are best illustrated when considering law enforcement responses to communities that present logistical challenges in simply arriving, such as Gamble and Savunga, the Pribilof Islands, Little Diomede, and communities toward the end of the Aleutian chain. Allowing for telephonic court appearances for all hearings where it is reasonable for that to occur would be one of the best solutions available. regarding criminal rule 38.1. I believe Ms. Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law is present in the courtroom, in the room there as well, and might be able to speak to that with more knowledge as necessary. With that being said, the current version of House Bill 205, version H, appears to provide enough leeway for law enforcement to effectively provide a balance between public safety and the need for defendants to be held responsible for their actions. The other main concern the DPS had regarding these changes revolved around the ability of law enforcement to arrest an individual for violating conditions of release, particularly with cases involving domestic violence. While this might be drifting away a bit from Section 42, I believe that the issue is closely enough related to the arrest versus cite conversation that it bears briefly mentioning again. But this appears to be covered. In Section 25, the language in AS 1156-757A regarding violating conditions of release is amended to conform to the reclassification of the crime to a violation, but it is answered in Section 42 on page 23 where the new law allows a peace officer to arrest a person if probable cause exists that the person violated conditions of release. DPS would also like to commend the sponsors of the bill for adding back in the provisions in AS 1225-180B4, the very next line, where arrest authority remains if a person is committing the crime of disorderly conduct. While this crime is relatively minor in comparison to all others, it allows the officer the ability to solve an immediate problem, which oftentimes means removing an unreasonably loud person who is causing a disturbance while others are trying to sleep. So with that said, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Do we have any questions for Lieutenant Hansen? Well, thank you. I appreciate your being here to testify. And you mentioned that Casey Schroeder was here also. And so the next person on the agenda is Ms. Schroeder.
But she's so excited.
She looks like she just can't wait to get up here.
She's one of our favorites.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Criminal Division, the Department of Law. Madam Chair, I don't know if I am the last speaker, but I feel like I am in an enviable position because many people have gone before me. I think Ms. Mee did an excellent job of explaining what the pretrial sections do, so I don't have anything to add there. The pretrial sections for Department of Law don't substantially change how we would do business. They would just basically give us additional tools when making bail arguments because we're going to be doing a risk-based analysis there. I do have a couple of technical things I can point out for the committee if they would like.
That would be great.
Okay. So in Section 42,
page 22.
Yes. The only technical thing I wanted to point out there is on page 23, line 8, that is the definition of sexual offense, and it's limited there. And every other section of the bill, the definition used is the definition found in 1263-100, which is a somewhat broader definition. So it would be a decision for the committee whether or not which definition they wanted to choose there. Crimes covered in 1263 would be like child pornography. Those crimes are covered in 1263 and not necessarily in what you have there.
And I apologize. What's the definition that you would typically use?
Typically, through the chair to Representative Kleeman, it would be 1263-100. It's found in that statute.
I'm sorry, through the chair.
Go ahead.
Sexual offense?
Correct.
Do you know, Ms. Schroeder, why it's Section 11 here and you're recommending that it's Section 12? How did that happen?
Madam Chair, I do not know how that happened. It seems to be a fluke because everywhere else the choice has been made to use the definition in Title 12.
Madam Chair, it could be a drafting error.
Correct.
Thank you.
And we can check. I can have Grace check.
The next thing I just wanted to point out is Section 48. That is the section that allows a defendant to use inability to pay as a reason to get a bail review hearing. The department... It would be page 24. The Department of Law was initially concerned that defendants would be able to use that reason over and over and over. You know, I can't pay, still can't pay, still can't pay. And so we would be having bail review hearings about every 7 days. The language that's in the bill now on page 25 appears to have addressed that concern. I did just want to make sure the committee was aware that that was a concern. It is addressed the way the language appears now.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Can you just state the line number?
So yes, it's page 25, line 7. And then sections 51 and 52, so those would be found beginning on page 25, and they continue for the next several pages. Those are the readjustment of the bail sections to incorporate the risk-based assessment. There are a number of crimes that are listed as exclusions. So, if, for instance, if you are convicted of failure to charged with failure to appear or charged with violating conditions of release, then you don't get the benefit of some of these presumptions for OR release. The committee may want to consider adding to that list. There are some crimes, for instance, terroristic threatening, possession of child pornography, escape, unlawful evasion, things that may be indicative of a higher risk or not willing to appear or abide by court orders. So just the committee may want to look at other crimes to add there. Just something to consider.
Representative Mellett?
Casey, would you mind giving the chair that list so we can talk about them?
Yes, no problem. Then the only other thing I just wanted to point out was Mr. Steiner addressed Section 61 with the pretrial electronic monitoring release. Ms. Abbott was correct that that is a bill that was before this committee last year, and it has only been effective as of this summer. So it's fairly recent. That section only addresses credit for pretrial electronic monitoring. So a defendant would still potentially be eligible for electronic monitoring after they are sentenced and once they are under DOC custody. So it's just so that it's clear, there is not a bar once you're sentenced on getting credit for electronic monitoring. It's just the pretrial portion.
Thank you.
And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
I actually have a question with respect to the disorderly conduct. So I understand why you'd want to get somebody out of the place where they're being disorderly and do it right then and there. I'm just wondering if there could be a place other than prison that they're taken to. I mean, because disorderly conduct usually isn't that much more than just being a loud jerk in the wrong place.
Madam Chair, are you suggesting a sleep-off center for jerks?
I actually don't know what I'm suggesting. I'm asking for suggestions as to what to suggest, because we've just heard about all of the problems with putting low-level people into jail, even for as much as 8 hours. And now we've got an exception for disorderly conduct, which is, I mean, on the scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest and 1 being the lowest, it seems more like a 1 than a 10. And we're going to be arresting these people and putting them actually in jail where they might become hardened criminals. So what's the solution? That's what I'm asking for, is a suggested solution.
And, Madam Chair, can I comment on that?
Go ahead.
Maybe we should get Lieutenant Hansen back on the line, and maybe he has some, I'm not sure Department of Law has.
Madam Chair, we're not prepared to address that right now. I understand the concern, and I know that the new Commissioner for Department of Corrections has mentioned that with respect to Title 47 holds. So it is something that it's definitely in our minds. But, yeah, Lieutenant Hansen may have additional comments.
Great idea. Lieutenant Hansen, are you still with us?
I'm here, Madam Chair.
So have you been following this dialogue?
Yes, I have. The answer to your question is, you know, the allowing law enforcement to retain the ability to arrest someone for the crime of disorderly conduct, basically it just allows us to, like I had mentioned, to solve a problem that's sort of an immediate concern for the night. You know, I think that there's probably a little bit of a misconception that if a trooper responds somewhere and someone is being unreasonably loud, that the first course of action we would take would be to arrest them. That's certainly not the case. You know, oftentimes we would ask if they have any place to sleep it off. Do you have a friend's house that you could go to? Can we give you a ride somewhere? You know, all of these options are generally presented to a person. The times where we're talking about keeping that ability to arrest the person is where the level of belligerence is so high and the problem cannot otherwise be resolved by just giving them a ride somewhere or having them go to a friend's house, where if we leave and we don't have any other course of action and we simply cite them for something, the problem is going to continue and the troopers or whomever, whatever the agency is, would keep going back again and again and again. So this would be sort of, I guess to sort of address your specific question, be viewed as a last resort option, but it's still an ultimate solution which would provide peace to the neighborhood for the night, if you will.
Thank you. Representative Mellett.
Thank you, Lieutenant Hansen. So, correct me if I'm wrong, when you take someone who's inebriated to a sleep-off center, they cannot be under arrest, and they cannot be causing physical harm to themselves or others. So you're not arresting them, you're taking them, giving them the opportunity to go to a sleep-off center. But if they are belligerent and they are causing a disturbance and they don't want to willingly go to a sleep-off center, that would be the instance where you would need to make the arrest and then take them, and it wouldn't be to the sleep-off center, it would be to a jail cell, correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Millett, I believe you're assessing that correctly. I mean, I hate to speak with such a broad brush that it applies to all situations, but, you know, in order to just solve a problem that, as Madam Chair put it, you know, is a one on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, our intent would not be to just simply charge someone for the sake of charging them. You know, if the problem would come about when you have someone who's being belligerent that way, who is not impaired, they haven't been drinking, they aren't on any sort of prescription or illicit narcotic, and you know, now we're having to deal with them. We're going to a sleep-off center. Isn't the intent of it, where we have to just remove them because they're so angry or upset? And I think it would apply more in those circumstances, but if it's something where, like you had suggested, Representative Millett, where it's something where, sleep it off, kind of like with the Anchorage Police Department, what they do downtown, and they have the sort of the sleep-off centers there, that would certainly be the option that we would prefer over charging someone criminally.
Thank you. Representative Clayman?
Lieutenant or Sergeant? I apologize. I'm
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant. I'm seeing this particular disorderly conduct provision about the 24 hours is kind of one of the many tools you would have in the toolbox. Particularly, you were talking about rural Alaska. You might have actually a disorderly conduct scenario that doesn't involve alcohol, and you were just trying to get people in different to separate and have a cooling off period. And one tool the officer might have would be to basically say, "Come with me, and you're going to go to your house a couple blocks away until you can cool off." And the ability to say, if you really don't want to go to home, I can take you to jail, that becomes a tool the officer can use. And so I'm seeing this particular statute as kind of a range of toolboxes in the officer's tool chest, if it were. Am I missing something, or can you kind of give me a little more insight in that?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I believe that you're right on track with what you're thinking here. You know, the desire of DPS to sort of retain this ability to arrest, you know, we haven't, over the course of time, this isn't a charge that is, you know, anywhere near one of the most, you know, the most common charges that come up. This is something where, you know, like I had mentioned, it is sort of a last resort where we're looking at this where there's a problem in a community or in a neighborhood, and if we don't take some sort of action and this person doesn't have somewhere else to go and they're not impaired, you know, then what do we do with them? So, you know, the DC charge, you know, and we're not even necessarily that interested that the person be spending that much time in jail. I mean, we agree, DPS agrees with the fact that it was brought down, you know, from a 10-day to a 24-hour period in the recent rewrite. So again, I believe Representative Klayman, you're correct in your assessment that this is a tool that allows us to take care of a problem, and it's sort of a last result tool after the trooper or whichever officer offers every opportunity for this person to go away, if you will, and they refuse to do so. This gives us the ability to solve the problem.
And then one follow-up.
Go ahead.
And I take it in the reverse situation where you do have somebody that's extremely intoxicated, the officer would actually have a choice to either take him to the sleep-off center under Title 47 and not arrest them, or if they were getting complete non-cooperation on why don't you come to the sleep-off center, another option would be at that point finally to arrest if there was just nothing else, but again, as a last resort, as you're describing.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Klayman, that's correct. I can't speak to all areas of the state that they would have a sleep-off center. So in areas, and I'll sort of go back to Western Alaska where the troopers operate a lot, you know, if something is going on in a community where there is not a sleep-off center, disorderly conduct might be the only resolution to that. However, I do know that a lot of the jails, if there's a high level of inebriation in someone or impairment, other impairment in someone, that it would require going to the hospital and having the prisoner checked out to make sure that they would be healthy enough to be put in jail. So there's a few forks in the road here that would you know, that still apply depending on the community and the situation. But I believe that your assessment is correct. Yes,
Representative Mallett.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I think it would be beneficial if we did have someone from APD, because there are specific rules on the sleep-off center on nonviolent people and people that are not. I did a ride along, and I think the criteria was not causing harm to themselves or cause harm to another. The last thing that you want to do at the sleep-off center is put someone in there who's combative with another group of inebriates that may be riled up. So there is, I think, an anchorage. The disorderly conduct has been used for that purpose.
Thank you. So, do I have any other questions for Casey here?
I do have a question for Casey. I didn't have any more for the lieutenant, though.
Thank you, Lieutenant. And if you could stay with us until the end of the meeting, we'd really appreciate it, because things may come up again.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Casey, I want to go back to your comments about Section 61, and because I'm trying to make sure that I'm tracking some of our discussions last year. With regard to pre-sentence electronic monitoring, wasn't it the conclusion that we reached, at least my memory is that we had a lot of discussion about good time credit for pre-trial electronic monitoring, and after a lot of discussion, we did not try to create a structure for good time credit for pretrial release, because that essentially opened a much bigger can of worms that was too complicated to try to fix. And so that for purposes of a pretrial electronic monitoring, it's day-for-day credit, whereas post-trial, you're on a good time credit where you get a third off.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, through the Chair, Representative Klayman, under current law, even post-sentencing, when someone's on DOCEM, they are not eligible for good time. This bill would change that. Not that specific section. It would be later in the Title 33 provisions, later in the bill. But your recollection is correct. I remember that initially the bill did have some good time stuff in it, and then I think in one of the early iterations, the good time stuff was taken out.
Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. So the next folks that we have are Kerry Belden, April Wilkerson, and Sherry Daigle from the Department of Corrections.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sherry Daigle. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections is just here today to answer questions. I have the Admin Services Director, April Wilkerson, online, as well as Carrie Belden, our Director of Probation and Parole. So if we can answer any questions, we'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
Getting off easy.
That was a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So we have a number of people here who are here for general questions. So let's see who I have on the line. Quinlan has left us, but Tracy is here in the room. If anybody has questions for Tracy, Grace is still here. We have Jeff Edwards, who is with the Parole Board. We've got Mary Geddes, who is a staff attorney for the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. We've got Elisa Wooden with the Division of Behavioral Health. We've got Claire Sullivan from Department of Corrections, Suzanne DiPietro from the Judicial Council, or Brenda Stanfield, Commissioner for the Criminal Justice Commission. So do we have any questions that we want to ask any of these folks? Okay. Representative Mellett.
Maybe we could see if any of those have any background on this section that would be helpful that we haven't addressed.
I think that's an excellent idea. So anybody who is in the room or online, do you have any background or expertise or want to comment on any of the pretrial provisions? I'm not hearing overwhelming responses here. Ms. Wallenberg, do you want to come up here? Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Tracy Wallenberg, and I'm the Deputy Public Defender for the Appellate Division at the Public Defender Agency, and I work with Quinlan Steiner. And I know he already talked about Section 61, but it occurred to me while I was sitting there and listening to the additional testimony about it that I did want to make one further point. I know there's been a lot of discussion that the purpose behind that provision may have been the potential for abuse or delay caused by people who are on pretrial EM. I just wanted to point out for the committee's benefit that there are also people, and I, as the supervisor of the appeals section, I can state this with some experience, that are on EM on bail pending appeal. And it seems as if the provision as written would limit credit for the time that people are spent on bail pending appeal as well, even when that rationale sort of has evaporated. People, I think the bill is structured to allow credit for people, and I don't know how frequently this happens, but people who are released on EM pending a petition to revoke probation. Where I would also think the sort of rationale that was discussed earlier would sort of fall away. So I just wanted to point that out for the committee's benefit. And maybe, and this is responsive to Representative Millett's question to Quinlan, maybe if the provision doesn't come out entirely, there may be a way to sort of put limits on it that addresses those concerns.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else from that list of people that I...
All participants are unmuted.
Hello, this is Mary Geddes.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you, Representative Ledoux? Thank you so much for this opportunity to participate. I wanted to note that Commissioner Stanfield just sent me a text saying that she would like to offer some commentary, but her line has been muted. So I know that she is standing by. I just simply thought I would offer...
Mary, can you, before you get any further, just for the record, can you just identify yourself?
Yes, through the chair. My name is Mary Geddes. I'm staff attorney for the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you.
And just very briefly, I just wanted Representative Millett to know that I had provided a memo to Grace Abbott concerning her question yesterday about the extent to which someone held pretrial in a CRC or a private treatment program is eligible for time served credit against a prison sentence later imposed. I have researched that, written up a short memo, and I just wanted to make sure that you knew that it was available to you.
And I believe that memo is on everybody's desks.
I just wrote that about 11 o'clock, so I'm not sure whether or not you've seen it, but I just wanted to let you know that I did follow up on that, and I will just, and unless there are any other questions, I'll just defer to Commissioner Stanfill.
Thank you.
I did have one follow-up for Ms. Gathers.
Representative Clayman.
Mary, the memo that you wrote that we do have that's dated today about credit for time served in a treatment program, that's what we commonly refer to as Nygren credit, relating to the Nygren case that's now several years old?
Yes, and Nygren was effectively superseded by a statute. And yes, that's what I'm referring to.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also a question for Mary in her answer to the first question in the memo, which I think was an answer to one of the questions, at least I was trying to sort of touch on yesterday, regarding risk factors. The memo says we would look at factors that are predictive. The weight of each risk factor varies by jurisdiction, and further notes that variations based on differences in statutes, data quality, et cetera. And I was curious what the quality of our data in Alaska is.
So that's a long answer, and I'll be happy to follow up with a written memo if that would be helpful, Representative, through the chair.
Go ahead.
Is there a short answer, or sort of a sense of how Alaska's data stacks up relative to other states that have implemented risk-based, trying to calculate risk based on data?
Well, as I said, I think that there certainly is data that we've been able to collect and analyze and is in the process of being analyzed also for the purposes of a Results First project, which is going to evaluate cost-effective measures that are being employed here compared to elsewhere. But I think in terms of answering the specific question about risk assessment, I would really have to get into the details of each of those states' programs to compare it to our own. And so I think that's why it needs to be a more long-winded response and better taken care of in a written document.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else for Ms. Geddes? Well, thank you very much for being with us. And do we have Brenda on the line?
I am here. Thank you.
Great. Do you want to begin by identifying yourself?
Yes, Brenda Stanfill, and I'm here as a commissioner on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk about the area of victims' rights and how victims are represented in what we're trying to do pretrial. And one of the things that there has been an ongoing look is to make sure that we do not lose the victims' rights to have an ability to speak. So the victim has the right to speak at the hearings. And when someone's coming out on pretrial, then we want to make sure that because we've said someone is going to be released on their own recognizance does not mean that what a victim comes in and talks about in terms of regards to their safety or their feelings or different things is not weighed in the judge's ability to decide how he's going to go forward with pretrial. And so I think a lot of times when we think about your own recognizances in those lower level, low risk crimes, we think, oh, we just let you out. But the one thing that the victim's voices are still very much represented here, so let's say, for instance, someone's arrested on a low-level crime for destroying someone's mailbox. And the victim shows up at court and says, here's the thing, though. This isn't the first time this has happened. This is just the first time I've called law enforcement. This has happened 8 different times. I think maybe they're actually trying to steal my mail. You know, maybe there's some other things that come out when the victim talks that the judge may decide, you know, I'm going to let this person out on OR. However, I'm going to put conditions in place to protect the victim. So I'm going to say you can't be within so many feet of this victim's home. Or maybe I'm going to require, if I think alcohol is involved, maybe I am going to require some type of monitoring for alcohol or substances. So OR does not mean no requirements. So the victim's voice very much still matters in this case. So There's been some confusion on that somehow victims' rights would be lost, and I do believe that we really looked at this during the process of the commission, trying to make sure that at the first and foremost of what we were doing is that we did not lose victims in this process. One of the things in all my years of working with victims that has been my biggest complaint about the criminal justice systems is that victims are lost. Once they're victimized and this is turned over to the criminal justice system, they seem to be this kind of byproduct, this thing that exists when front and center they should be in terms of this case. So I do believe that we're still very much keeping them in that role and possibly giving them even a little bit more because we're trying to do things a little smarter in this area. I also wanted to answer just a few questions that you had. You asked me if I felt that third-party custodians were effective in a list there. And I wanted to tell you that no, for the most part, third-party custodians are not effective. Normally that's going to be someone they know, someone who loves them, someone who cares about them, someone who may be making excuses for their behavior, and oftentimes they do not call that person in when they've done something wrong or when they have left. So they're not. However, from my victim services hat, I do think that there are a few instances where a third party is really helpful. In instances where we have sexual abuse against a minor, we're not so much concerned about where the person is at, which that is concerning, but where they're at, but also who is there. And I think that that's where that set of eyes is really important, and I don't know that the pretrial supervision piece can do that whole thing. That's something from a victim standpoint we're still looking at, but I would say that could be an area if you're looking at the third party. And the citation policy already does have a carve out for the domestic violence. We made very clear that domestic violence offenses, including those that are not assault but have a DV mark, those do not qualify as a citation. And victims under the current pretrial release system, as I said, victims sometimes get lost in this. And so I think this is not making it worse for them, but I think this will give us avenues in order to put more things in place through having pretrial supervision. And I'll just tell you that last week the story about the man who raped the woman and then went and found her and abducted her, had that person been on electronic monitoring, that most likely could not have occurred. We would have known when they left the house. We would have known where that he went. Instead, we relied on a third party, and luckily someone looked out a window and saw what he was doing when he was abducting the victim. So there is a lot of ways that I feel like, from the victim standpoint, having more tools in our toolbox for pretrial is going to make people much safer. It's also going to ensure that a risk assessment is done prior. That's currently not done. If you have the money to get out of jail, you get out of jail. So I do think in the grand scheme of how this is all going to play out, and it's going to take a little bit to get all of the bumps out of it, I do believe that victims will fare better under what has been proposed. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And thank you for all your services on behalf of victims, Brenda.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
Brenda, just said, it sounds like specifically with regard to third-party custodians, you've come to really agree with the broad recommendation of the commission that we're kind of overusing third-party custodians in the present scenario. Doesn't mean do away with it entirely. In fact, you identified some cases like sexual abuse of a minor where it's appropriate, but sounds like you think there's a whole bunch of other cases that we need to stop using third-party custodians because it's not helping us.
I do agree that it's not, especially in cases, I specifically domestic violence cases or cases where you have somebody on a third party due to someone's injured in a traffic incident that has to do with drinking. I do think you're putting a lot of responsibility on someone. It's very hard to find that neutral party. So it's going to be someone who loves and cares about this person, and now you're giving them the responsibility to turn this person in, which is going to result in their rearrest in continuing problems. I believe that's a very hard situation. I can't tell you how many women who are mothers of men who have been accused of battering behavior have ended up coming into my agency to do volunteer work and community service to work off the crime that they then committed by not turning in the person when they left off of the third party or not. So I think it just results in a whole lot of what we think is safety that really no one is safer in those circumstances.
Follow up? Thank you. Well, before we adjourn, I actually got a couple more questions for Ms. Wilkerson. Is she still online?
Yes, I am here.
Thank you.
Questions for Suzanne DiPietro.
Okay. So could you explain, Ms. Wilkerson, what pretrial supervision would look like?
To the chair, the department is still in the development process to actually determine and identify how it will actually look and operate. We're reviewing other states that have implemented pretrial, and in coordinating with that and working with Pew and law and the court system.
Sorry, Ms. Wilkerson. I forgot, my trusty aide just pointed out that I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself and put your affiliation on the record.
I apologize. My name is April Wilkerson. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Now that we've got that out of the way, you can proceed.
The Department of Corrections is currently in the process of reviewing to develop and determine how the pretrial services will actually look and operate under the Department of Corrections. We're looking at other states that have implemented this service, and we plan in the first year to continue to work with Pew and the Department of Law and the courts to actually define the program.
Okay, so when do you think you'll have more definition?
To the chair, again, this is April Wilkerson. We hope that in coordinating with our new commissioner, we hope to have a better picture and a better handle within the next, hopefully within the next few weeks.
So that hopefully before this bill gets passed, we'll know what pretrial supervision is actually going to look like?
To the chair again, this is April Wilkerson. Yes, but I am confident that prior to the legislation being passed, we would be in a better place to define that.
Thank you. So I'm sure you'll be coming back to us, and we'll get to ask you some more questions. Will you be giving us a report? How will that work?
To the chair again, this is April Wilkerson with the Department of Corrections. We can do it either way. We can define the report, or we can provide an outline of what the program or what we envision the program looking like as it develops up.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch, and we'll figure out how to do it. Did you have another question, Representative Klayman?
I had some questions for Suzanne DiPietro.
Before Suzanne DiPietro, does anybody else have any questions for Ms. Wilkerson? So I just have one more question for you then. Are you going to be able to, is the Department of Corrections going to be able to provide the risk assessments, which this bill refers to, in time for the first appearance before a judge?
Through the chair, again, this is April Wilkerson, the Director of Admin Services. We do anticipate being able to meet that, and the fiscal note is pretty high on the staffing that would be needed to ensure that we are in compliance with that assessment requirement.
Thank you. More questions for?
Not for Ms. Wilkerson.
All right, thank you very much. You have a question, have some questions for Ms. Pietro?
Yes, please.
Suzanne, are you here with us? Suzanne DiPietro? She's not here any longer.
Oh.
So we'll do it some other time.
Who else is still on the line? Somebody else may be able to answer the questions.
Is there? Why don't you ask your question, and we'll figure out if there's somebody there here who can answer it.
One question I had is whether third-party custodians are currently being used as a replacement for money bond.
Is there anybody from either the public defender's office?
Hello, this is Mary Geddes.
Hi, thank you. And you want to identify yourself?
Yes, this is Mary Geddes again. I'm the staff attorney for the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and I apologize, Chairwoman Ledoux, in terms of Suzanne's unavailability. She actually was double scheduled to participate in a radio program at this hour, so she had to leave. With respect to the question that was asked by Representative Klayman through the chair, I can offer some information. The Alaska Judicial Council participated with Puke Charitable Trust Justice Reinvestment Initiative in conducting a study of pretrial release information from five different courts in Alaska this past last year. Actually, the information was drawn from offenders who had been released from Alaska's prisons in July and December of 2014. And there's actually a manual review, a hand review of these court cases for bail information. And I think one of the most interesting results of that survey was that although third-party custodians were originally proposed as an alternative, originally thought of as an alternative to orders for cash bail being posted, the experience, as reflected in these records, is very different in these five court locations in the survey of these particular cases, because for 23% of the sample defendants had a third-party custodian requirement, but they also had a corresponding money bail condition. So it was an additional condition beyond the money bail that was imposed in those cases. And perhaps unsurprisingly, three-quarters of the defendants with a third-party custodian requirement were not released before trial. So that's the information I have to offer from that study.
Just as a follow-up on that question, or that first question, so what I'm hearing is that actually having money bail and a third-party custodian actually made it more, even less likely that the defendant would get out of jail.
That was, I think, a takeaway from the study. That's a reasonable takeaway from the study.
Okay. And then I have a different question through the chair that we'll see if you can answer that as well. And that is whether releasing someone on a secured bond versus an unsecured bond has any impact on their likely return for court on the scheduled court date.
Well, there is a study which I'll be happy to summarize and send along to you, Representative Klayman. I beg your pardon, through the chair. The summarized evaluation.
Can you identify yourself for the record? This makes it so much easier for the court reporter, and I know it anyway.
Certainly, through the chair. This is Mary Geddes again, a staff attorney for the Criminal Justice Commission. And the question, I believe, from Representative Klayman was whether, basically, what do the studies bear out in terms of the risk, I guess, of failures to appear or noncompliance with orders or new criminal offenses. What is the relative value of release on secured bond versus unsecured bond? I know there have been a couple of studies that have addressed that specific question, and I'll be happy to summarize them or get you the studies themselves.
Through the chair, if you could go ahead and summarize them briefly, I think we'd be interested in seeing the studies, but if you could summarize them, that's always very helpful.
Well, I think in a nutshell, those studies reflect that the requirement of money bail is no greater guarantee of compliance with bail orders. That they are equally effective or ineffective, I guess, either way.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Klayman? Is there anybody else who has any questions that we might try to find somebody who can answer them? All right, it is 2 20, and we're going to hold this bill over, and we'll see you all on Friday, 12:30 again, and we stand adjourned, and it is 2:20.
Now, what are you going to be doing?